The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and on the Breakfast Grill with me this morning is Dominic Volek, head of the Southeast Asia division of Henley & Partners. Henley & Partners describes itself as a global citizenship and residence advisory firm. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Dominic. I want to begin with what I understand is part of the history of Henley & Partners. Would it be correct to say that Henley & Partners pioneered policies of citizenship by investment, first in the Caribbean nation of St. Kitts and Nevis, and then later expanding to Antigua, to St. Lucia, Grenada and Cyprus, helping these countries develop their own citizenship by investment programs. So would that be an accurate way of describing the start?
Yeah, certainly. So Henley & Partners, as you said, is a residence and citizenship advisory firm. So there's actually two arms to the business. The first is, as you've pointed out, government advisory. So we have a thriving government advisory team. Our chairman and CEO, Dr. Christian Callan, he's effectively touted with having pioneered the whole industry. So in the early 90s, he started to do a lot of trips to the Caribbean, which is really where citizenship by investment started. St. Kitts and Nevis is probably the most well-known country in this space. Their program actually started back in 1984, but was never very successful, at least not to the point where we got involved. So Dr. Chris Callan was going to the Caribbean, and he sort of went to the St. Kitts and Nevis government and said, this could be a lot more popular. The reason for that is all of these countries, and there's a couple of them in the Caribbean, are all independent Commonwealth countries, which the real attraction there is the visa-free access that they provide to nationals of countries that maybe don't have strong passports from a travel freedom perspective. So St. Kitts and Nevis currently has visa-free access to 136 countries around the world. You compare that to maybe someone sitting in the Philippines who has visa-free access only to 61 countries, or Sri Lanka or Bangladesh that have access to 38 countries. These individuals, of course, if they are wealthy enough, financial capacity does come into these programs, they are then able to invest into a country like St. Kitts. Either they can contribute to a government fund or invest into real estate, and that then entitles them to become a citizen, and then they get a passport, and with that they can now have travel freedom to Europe, the UK, Singapore, Hong Kong, and all of these types of destinations.
I mean, what's interesting is the idea of investment, and in the kind of willing buyer, willing seller scenario that would be operating in all these instances, the word investment is a curious one, because does it somehow hide the fact that it's essentially citizenship by sale? I mean, basically, a country selling a citizenship for a particular price, or whatever the price point might be. The question of whether this then goes into real investments into the economies of these countries or not is by the by. I mean, would that be fair to say?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. And from our perspective, we don't offer all programs. So there are countries that have citizenship by investment programs or a version of it that we don't offer to our clients. So we have quite a strict internal due diligence in terms of which of these country programs they need to meet our own standards that we use in developing these programs for other countries. And of course, as much as we want our client, the private individual, to obtain the benefits of travel freedom or settlement freedom or the ability to move somewhere else, they also need to benefit the government. So this is really important. Where it's a one-sided case, and there are some programs where it has been the case where the government ends up in a worse-off position after this individual has invested, we don't get involved in those programs. So in the Caribbean, I think in the heydays of the St. Kitts and Nevis program, before some of the other countries also introduced their own programs, anywhere between 25 and 40% of their gross domestic product would come from their citizenship by investment program. So through the government advisory work that we've done in multiple countries, we've raised over $6 billion in foreign direct investment. And this is getting plowed into different types of funds that are established. So,
but are the people who buy into these programs really that interested in some sort of a return on investment for the money they bring to those countries? Or are they saying, look, I'm going to put $1 million down for the citizenship, and that's what I'm paying for, essentially. And if this money is used, to help the industry or not, is really inconsequential to them.
Yeah, look, I mean, some clients are purely after a better travel document.
Yeah, that would be so. Okay, so now it sets up this other question, and I think it's come up in the history of your organization as well, is the question of the use of these programs by people who are either trying to escape something or trying to parlay this new citizenship for maybe activities that are less than honest, nefarious, maybe, you know, the idea that criminals might be seeing this as a real way of maybe even money laundering, you know, laundering the money they've gotten and also entering into new zones for activities.
Yeah, look, it's a very valid concern and a very real risk. I'll speak firstly on sort of from a Henley perspective. We do very strict due diligence on any clients that we onboard. So before we, you know, engage into any agreements or anything, we would always do our own due diligence.
Isn't there kind of moral hazard in the game? Because when you look at small countries for whom their resources are something like this, I mean, just the sheer accident of history means, you know, St. Kitts and Nevis can, has something that people around the world want, rich people want. You know, why wouldn't they lower the bar just in order to get that investment?
They can't afford to because, you know, you have... If you look in the Caribbean, all of the investment amounts are dollar-based and they're going through U.S. intermediary banks. So the U.S., of course, has an eye on this. And from that perspective, the due diligence is having a program started back in 1984, of course, access to technology and databases has increased and just got better and better. So the due diligence processes have gone through ups and downs as they've developed. But now you have very robust programs that, you know, any client that comes in gets a full background verification check by a third-party provider. They have to provide police clearance certificates for their place of origin as well as anywhere where they've resided in the last 10 years. So with anything... You know, the due diligence process have got stricter and stricter. If you look at a program like Malta, the multi-individual investor program, that has, in terms of relatively speaking, the highest levels of due diligence in the world. It's the only citizenship by investment program that is endorsed by the European Union. And there they will commission two external background verification reports on any individual coming in. And that's after the fact that we've done as a company our own due diligence on these people. So...
Yeah, so Europe is a fascinating case in point. Malta is a tiny island nation within the European Union. Cyprus as well, you mentioned earlier. And I'm thinking about the poorer parts of Europe now, you know, maybe seeing this as an opportunity to, again, you know, use the facts of history in order to reap some sort of reward. Are there limits to say, for instance, how many people Malta could take on as citizens, considering that there's a general backlash in Europe against increasing citizenship through other means, and we're going to be talking about that later, refugees and such?
First of all, one point to make is, of course, citizenship by investment is a sensitive, emotive topic and industry. But to put it in context, if you look at the European Union as a whole, you know, I think the last data was 2015. There were 800,000 passport citizenships issued. Citizenship by investment makes up less than 0.1% of that. So in a country like Malta, the Malta Individual Investor Program has a cap. So it's not an annual cap. It is a cap for the program where they will only accept 1,800 applications. Of course, you know, it's been incredibly successful, so it's very likely that there will be an additional quota that may be added. A country like Cyprus currently does not have a cap, but upon further scrutiny now, as of last month, the finance minister there has now said that, well, potentially we should also introduce a cap. So whether it's an annual cap, and we see these introduced in the Canadian programs and the US EB-5, there are caps on programs. Cyprus is probably going to go that way, and Malta already has that.
On the receiving end, there'd be people who perhaps say, well, you know, these guys are citizens, but they really have no connection to this country, and it's opportunistic, right? On the sending side, as it were, you have offices in Malaysia, I believe also in Bangladesh. There, the dynamics are different. These would be rich individuals in those countries who are looking for opportunities or giving themselves a sort of insurance policies, as it were, to deal with the contingencies. Now, citizens in their countries would be looking at them and saying, well, oh, this is very nice because you're going to be jumping as soon as the ship starts sinking. And is there a desire on the part of those individuals to avail themselves of your product not to be known?
Yeah, look, confidentiality is a big a big part of this business, as it is for any wealthy people with lots of financial needs, particularly here in Southeast Asia. If you look in, you know, the Philippines and Indonesia, the threat of extortion and kidnapping, if this type of information falls into the wrong hands, is a very real risk for a lot of our clients. But the fact of the matter is there's clients throughout Asia who are looking for better travel freedom, better settlement freedom, opportunities for their kids. So the focus on the next generations, and, you know, if I am I'm a South African, so I have the same travel restrictions. I need a visa every time I travel anywhere. If I had the opportunity and the financial ability to invest into Cyprus or Malta, get a European passport, and I know my kids can go to school in Europe at the subsidized rates of an EU national, they can go and work in Europe, they don't have to worry about visas. It's a life-changing thing that we can do for these people, or that they can do for themselves.
Okay, so I understand in Bangladesh, they hold passports that have very limited play in this regard. Malaysia, on the other hand, is Malaysians hold a very good passport. We have access to, you know, over 130 countries, I believe.
Yeah, 164.
So what is the incentive for Malaysian individuals? How many Malaysians are knocking on your doors for such services?
What one must always keep in mind is whether your country allows dual citizenship or not.
Is that central to this game?
Yeah, so all the
in Bangladesh, would that be possible?
So if you look at Asia, you've got Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and the Philippines that allow dual citizenship. You know, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, they don't allow it. There's no law that says you can't apply for a second citizenship, but if you get that alternative citizenship, you should renounce or relinquish your existing one. But that also then has all sorts of implications on whether you can own land in that country. So it's a big decision. That said, you know, there are a lot of non-Malaysian citizens living in Malaysia, which we help with citizenship by investment. But as much as we talk about citizenship by investment, we also do a lot of residence by investment. So this is similar concept where you significantly invest into a country like the UK. You can invest £2 million. And you get a resident visa to go live in the UK for 5 years. And after 5 years, you can become a permanent resident. There's no restriction on a Malaysian or a Singapore to become a permanent resident in the UK or Australia or New Zealand. So there we do a lot of business. Portugal has a very interesting golden resident permit program that even if you're an Indonesian, again, their passport's not very good from a travel perspective, but with an EU resident permit, not citizenship, they have freedom of movement in the Schengen, which is another big bonus. So there's other ways and means of doing it, but particularly here in Malaysia, for Malaysia nationals, yes, there's those that would look to relinquish their Malaysian citizenship because of the benefits of having a European citizenship.
How many Malaysians? Could you give us a ballpark figure?
I mean, we generally, like I said, confidentiality is key. So,
well, I'm just looking for a number, not for names.
Look, it's not a lot. We do a lot of
Are we talking about dozens? Stuff. Like, are we doing hundreds?
No, not hundreds. No. Far less than 100 each year. But the focus for Malaysian nationals is very much residence by investment, Portugal, UK, these types of places.
I kind of suspect people are going to be, you know, knocking down our doors to get your phone number after this. But you said 2 million for a residency in the UK, you said £2 million. What about citizenship in Malta and Cyprus? How much would that set you back?
So Malta and Cyprus are pure citizenship by investment. You invest or contribute and you become a citizen.
And how much?
Cyprus is €2 million, which is typically, there's a few options. You can either put it into real estate, you can put it into alternative financial instruments, or into Cypriot businesses. But because of what the real estate market is doing in Cyprus, particularly after the global financial crisis and the way it's picking up, 90% of our clients would buy real estate. Residential real estate, they buy a villa on the beach in Ayia Napa for €2 million, and in 6 months they obtain European citizenship. Malta, on the other hand, is primarily a donation program, but as I said, it really is the Rolls Royce of citizenship by investment. It's the only passport that gives you visa-free access to the US, as well as 167 other countries, plus the right to settle anywhere in Europe. So Malta, you've got a contribution, a donation to the government, starting at €650,000.
And which you can't take back, clearly.
Yeah, that's once you're approved, you then donate that to the government. It increases incrementally when you include your spouse and your children and parents. There's €150,000 that has to go into a government bond, which is very low risk. Malta is one of the top credit rate countries in Europe. That has to go into a bond for 5 years. And the third requirement, so you need to do all three, is to have real estate in Malta. This you can either purchase for a minimum €350,000, or you can take out a five-year lease, and that lease must be at least €16,000 per annum. So of the, you know, of the, at the moment, I think there's about 1,400 applications that have gone into Malta. Henley is the public concessionaire. We've done 70-80% of those, so we're very familiar with the program. Most of the clients would just lease an apartment in Malta. And that then ties back to your earlier comment on in terms of these people not establishing links to these countries. In Malta, they have to. So they have to have a property. They have to spend a bit of time there. They have to – it's not a lot of time. I mean, it's generally sort of 2 to 3 weeks prior to obtaining the citizenship. But they need to establish other links, whether it's, you know, gym memberships. And they really need to show that they want to be a Maltese citizen. It's not a case of –
they're losing weight.
Yeah.
I'm speaking to Dominic Volek, head of the Southeast Asia Division for Henley & Partners, a global citizenship and residence advisory firm. Next, we look at the question of refugees, demographic challenges that countries face, as well as the global competition for talent. I'm Sharad Kutin. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Welcome back. If you just joined us on the Breakfast Grill this morning is Dominic Volek, head of the Southeast Asia Division for Henley & Partners, a global citizenship and residence advisory firm. Next, we look at the question of refugees, as well as the question of the global competition for talent. I wonder if you can weigh in on this. But on refugees, in 2015, Henley & Partners formed a multi-year partnership with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. The firm said it would support the UNHCR with a contribution of $1 million, as well as act towards raising awareness for refugee causes. Now, it strikes me as really curious because when you look at the global movement of people, you know, it seemed like Henley & Partners is really looking at the creme de la creme, as it were. We already talked about Malta as the Rolls Royce of countries, and that's a very interesting expression. Refugees come from the other end. I mean, some of them might be highly educated people or qualified. It's just that the circumstances in which they're moving are very different. Why is it that Henley is and Partners is interested in refugees?
It's still a migration theme that's behind it all. But really, we know that we have very skilled, fortunate, wealthy clients. And at the level of wealth that these individuals, these are all high net worth, ultra high net worth individuals, and the philanthropic giving and what is in most of our clients is already there. So what we've done is to try and see how we can facilitate even more giving. So not only do we donate to UNHCR and we have this partnership with them, but from a social responsibility perspective, we try and instill in all our stakeholders, whether it's our employees, our clients, the intermediaries, and the, you know, the various, of course, we work with all the banks and lawyers. And what we try and do is take it a step further to really just create a lot of awareness about this. So we have, I think the last count is an event somewhere globally every 2 weeks. So we have all of these events where these are discussions that we're always having. So now in November, we have our Global Residence and Citizenship Conference. It's the 11th one of the year. We've got that in Hong Kong in November, where we get all the different stakeholders in a room for 2 days. And on the end of that, we have a gala dinner, which all proceeds, we get all of our wealthy clients to come. And we really educate them on the plight of these refugees. A lot of the money we donate goes into the registration of the refugees, which is a critical part of the process to enable them to actually get registered and you know, be able to properly work in countries that they move to. And all of this is a continued effort, not only the donation we make, but also fundraising. We've just created our own foundation, the Andan Foundation, which will seek to further raise funds to give back to all of these causes. The UNHCR is just one of them.
You know, I'm wondering about the perspective of your clients and looking at Europe as a place to go to, you know, and site their businesses, place their families, you know, set up a new kind of future. And then at the same time, they're watching the news. They've bought a beachfront property and a poor people, desperate people are landing on beaches in Europe, accessing Europe, and eventually will be integrated in Europe. But already Germany, despite the pushback from populist pressures, seems to be willing to take these people on. So they're going to get citizenship and without having to put out so much money. I mean, does it rankle your clients? Do they see this as somehow not the Europe they want to buy into with a lot of poor people coming from their countries?
No, not really. I mean, a lot of the clients that we have also don't physically move to Europe. You mentioned earlier there's the insurance policy aspect of it. But those that do realize that they have a broader responsibility other than, you know, the benefits that what we do through citizenship by investment, what that can bring them, they realize there's a broader responsibility in terms of where they come from, particularly in sort of wealthy people from emerging countries and that type of thing. We can see what's happening with the Rohingya crisis in Bangladesh now. And a lot of our clients, before we even start to have that discussion with them around this, we find that they're already involved in these causes on their own, by their own values.
Kind of lastly, you know, there is the question of what countries get beyond the money. Are there examples that suggest that these high net worth individuals bring talent, or they bring new opportunities that are really changing the recipient countries, or is it largely insignificant?
Indirectly, when they're investing into real estate and Cypriot businesses, you know, unfortunately, there hasn't been any real sort of broader social economic study in terms of the broader benefits that these investments bring. But you can clearly see, if you look at a place like Cyprus, up until the end of October last year, two of the options for investing was into a government bond or a fixed deposit on a bank account. That does not benefit a country. And Cyprus realized that, and what they did as of the 1st of November is those two options were no longer available. So now it's got to be into a Cypriot business. You've got to come in, you've got to employ locals. Obviously, you pay taxes, and there's a lot more economic consumption happening.
And does it require for your clients now to be business savvy, to think about exactly, because the money that they invest is not something they can take away very easily. You put it into a business, it might be loss-making, no?
Yeah, correct. I mean, it's always an at-risk investment. And the clients know that, and this is the whole point of it is if you look at the equation for gross domestic product, there's investment, there's expenses, and there's consumption. And what was often lacking was the consumption. Singapore is a case in point. Singapore used to have the financial investor scheme. You could invest, I think it was originally $5 million. Most of that just went into real estate. They upped it to $10 million, and the demand just kept on coming. But what they realized, it was a once-off investment, and that was it. Now Singapore closed that program. Now you have the Global Investor Program, which sees you needing to invest $2.5 million into a business. That business must employ locals. It must have expenditure of at least $1 million. And the continued consumption within the economy, the taxes, wealthy people spend lots of money on retail goods and other consumer goods. And all of this is a continued consumption within the economy. And like I said, there's no study yet to really look at what all of these knock-on benefits are. Real estate industry, you look in the Caribbean, a place like Grenada, which has a very interesting program for a couple of reasons. There, they had very few five-star luxury resorts. Now you can invest into one of these, into an apartment in one of these resorts, and obtain citizenship. But of course, there's a whole building tourism industry behind that is created purely by that investment.
Fascinating. Sounds like countries are also learning slowly but surely how to, you know, leverage what they have against what your clients want.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Today, our guest on The Breakfast Grill was Dominic Volek, head of the Southeast Asia Division for Henley & Partners, a global citizenship and residency advisory firm. I'm Sharad Kutan for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.